it doesn't.
Welcome to Radio Syntax. In this episode, we're going to talk about sport, and more than that, the artfulness of sport. Because, think about it, if anything embodies all forms of art, it is sport. There's the figure, the human form, a portraiture painting, kind of, if you will. Because, really, what does all art find as commonality? Us, humans. Our shapes, our sizes, our emotions, our inner lives, our outer social lives. Our needs, our desires, our excesses, and also our triumphs. The human form is the through line in all art forms, really. It's what we understand the most. It's the grand metaphor for understanding all of life. In the beginning, all athletics are about movement and the human form. It's a kind of ballet. There's sculpture in that athletic movement and the creation of play designs, even. The ancient Greeks held this notion to the highest. The word gymnasium comes from the Greek word gymnos, meaning naked, actually. The athletes competed nude. It was a practice that they thought encouraged aesthetic appreciation of, namely, the male body, and it was also a tribute to the gods. For the Greeks, the gymnasium was a place for engaging in and watching athletic pursuits, but it was also a place of socializing and explicit intellectualism. In contemporary sport, the diagrams and plays are artful. All the lines, the X's and O's, they're abstract painting, they're drawing. Design. And extending this further, there's music in the sounds of the stadium, and the sound of sport, and the chants of players, the cheerleaders, and the inherent symphony of the game, the sneakers squeaking, helmets and shoulder pads crashing, skates cutting through the ice, the ball cracking off the sweet spot of the bat. And we shouldn't forget one of the most musical sounds of sport, the roar of the crowd, timed in unison as a sort of swell of liquid sound with a scoring play or a favorable move. There's music in the players as well, the quarterback's cadence, the coach's incessant harping and coaching. There's the uniform color palettes in the team jerseys, the home stadium's colors and scoreboards and lights and the fans' garb. Even the language of the game speaks of creative effort. There's players and they run plays. Sport is about something a little more primal, the simplicity of the human drive and need. It is child's play, but it's also a Greek tragedy. Play that takes place on a stage. But theirs is not a poetry that's spoken, it's enacted, with the human form as the bullhorn, a true kind of physicality that actors on a stage yearn for, a pure movement and action and reaction, a kind of freedom and honesty in form. The athletes exert their skill sets of shooting, running, and passing all in the name of creating opportunities for success, for a score. For certain, when a play is successful, it's heavenly, it's symphonic, if you will. With its score, its musicality, embedded into the shapes and forms and values of success. Maybe what's most important to me is that sport exemplifies virtues that are otherwise not apparent in daily life. On the playing stage, these age-old concepts and goals find their legs. On the playing field, you'll find the explicit manifest of things like strength and courage, perseverance and toughness, beauty and grace, and, yeah, artfulness. So, more than sport being something that is seen as artful and creative, it's really intellectual. It's a chess match. Within one game and one sport, there's hundreds of careful calculations embedded. To understand these games, there's a modicum of intellect that's required for the athletes, but for the observer as well. To this end, there's a kind of piecing together of information and data, synthesis to create knowledge, kind of creative knowledge, fresh ideas. Again, with the ancient Greeks, one of our forefathers and intellect, Plato, found virtue in sport and for a variety of reasons, one of them being intellectual practice. Plato saw sport as a connection of mathematics and the expertise of understanding the human form, a kind of perfecting and sculpting of that form, the body, to best manipulate itself in a sporting medium, namely against an opponent. I think we've lost sight of these notions within sport. Unless you're one who reads literature on athletics and thinks about the philosophies behind everything, you've probably missed these connections. For you, like those outside of the world of sport, that care not for it, athletics is probably about ogres and chads and Neanderthals. people with too much testosterone that are overreacting and wearing their baseball cap backwards. As a society, I think we're all guilty of this because we probably have lost sight of the beauty, the virtue of sport. But if you dig a little bit, they're available. They're there. There's great writers like Grantland Rice who articulated sport in a poetic and even elegant way. Rice was most famous for dubbing the backfield of the 1924 Notre Dame Fighting Irish football team as the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame, certainly a kind of biblical reference to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Rice famously wrote, "Outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the Four Horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they were known as famine, pestilence, destruction, and death. These are only aliases. Their real names are Stoldrer, Miller, Crowley, and Layden. They formed the crest of the South Bend cyclone before which another fighting army team was swept over the precipice at the Polo Grounds this afternoon as 55,000 spectators peered down upon the bewildering panorama spread out upon the green plain below. But if you fail to see the architecture and poetry in something that's written about a sport, maybe you can find it elsewhere, in one place in particular, a near holy place for my childhood, in a film company called NFL Films. NFL Films combined all the elements of art, film, music, even poetry. They're famous for their scores and their sound bites and really their elements of film that get up and close, personal with the game. They give you insight into a mysterious and really secretive world, oddly enough, a world that even spectators of a sport aren't allowed through these gates. If you look and watch and listen, NFL Films created a kind of sacredness, a kind of church of sport, if you will. It was even said that their first narrator, John Facenda, had the voice of God. In their movies, they told stories of teams and of sport and of particular games, but moreover, they told the stories of humanity and particular human beings. For if there's one reason why a story or an essay resounds with us, it's because it's about the human condition. It's a human interest story. And sport is no different. And NFL Films found that. They latched onto it and they blew it up.
The autumn wind is a pirate, blustering in from sea. With a rollicking song, he sweeps along, swaggering boisterously. His face is weather-beaten. He wears a hooded sash, with a silver hat about his head and a bristling black mustache. He growls as he storms the country, a villain big and bold. And the trees all shake and quiver and quake as he robs them of their gold. The autumn wind is a raider, pillaging just for fun. He'll knock you round and upside down and laugh when he's conquered and won.
I really do believe that this is probably the first place where I learned about art, poetry of life. When I was 5 and 6 and 7 years old, I began reenacting these plays that I saw in the videos, in the movies. I would replay them again and again and again in my basement, physically, out loud, with the roar of the crowd to complete it all, like a punctuation mark. And then, once I understood the language of the game, namely football for the most part, I began drawing my own scenarios, creating my own plays, my own stadiums, my own situations, my own Greek god status, to be honest. The victor in all of my games in the last second, coming from behind. In total, I really do believe that this created my first inner world. This helped create my first sense of imagination and creative outpouring. All through elementary school, I drew a lot, but mostly what I drew was football players and helmets and plays and football fields, logos. Certainly, I graduated on from that and began drawing band logos instead and drawing other things. But it was these formative years that really shaped me and have affected who I am as a human being now in my 30s. And really, that started with one momentous step when I was 6 years old. This is when I started playing football on a team, actively. Shoulder pads, helmets, knee pads. For the next 7 years of my life until I was 13, I had some of the fondest memories I've ever had in my entire life. Some of my greatest memories, greatest victories, worst defeats, memorable potpourris of scents and visions and auditory creations. While there were many successes, he won Super Bowls, and I was the quarterback, there was one memory, our second-to-last game, that stands out more than anything else. Probably one of the richest memories of my entire childhood. It sounds a little bit like this. I'm sure that outside of the pale of that experience, that doesn't sound like much to anybody else. It's taken off a VHS cassette from 1988. So the sound quality or the perfunctory sort of call is really there. But it was one of the most profound moments of my life. It was our second to last football game ever. We were the underdogs playing against a more highly touted Cherry Creek team. And we were losing very badly. So much so that I remember my mother leaving at halftime to spare herself the emotion, the investment. But we came back, and on the last play of the game, what you heard there was a touchdown pass that I threw off one foot as I was fading back from the pressure to a leaping tight end who miraculously caught it in the end zone. Pandemonium really erupted on our sideline, disbelief on theirs. It was euphoric. There was photographs taken of that moment, and I don't know how or why this person shot these photographs, but they are some of the most profound photographs I've ever seen. Maybe because they have to do with me. Again, maybe because it's the artfulness of my connection with the world. I have no real contact with any of the players from that team, from that time, from those 7 years of my life. And so I have nobody to really ask if they remember that game, if it impacted them in the way that it did for me, if not just create an amazing memory of your childhood, one of the last memories of your real childhood, before adolescence and high school and moving on and growing up. But I learned that I wasn't alone, for after some research and reaching out, I found really the orchestrator, the conductor of all of that, one of the heroes of my entire life. Coach from that day.
Then that field, when you got there, that smell, the vibes coming out of that field, it's quiet when you get there, and it starts building, you know, and we're just kids out there with family and friends in the audience, but there was nothing like it, was there?
And he's right. There wasn't really anything like it to this day. There was a sense of kinship between all of us that had been together for 7 years. There was a particular regimen, a cadence to it all, a feel, a sort of poetry to it. And that all started really with two men, or two coaches, Coach Scott and Coach Forty, who were two very intriguing men that took it upon themselves to coach us for 7 years. Every fall, they dropped what they were doing and came to work with us in earnest, in humility, and for pride. They were incredibly passionate about football and really more than that about coaching and really more than that about coaching us. In all my adult years of reaching out and trying and aiming for success, I always wanted a mentor. I wanted someone who was wise, a person who could help guide me and move me. And apart from my parents, I really didn't find that in my life. So I thought, really. Because if I look back, there was two people that helped form me. It just happened to be a little bit earlier on than I maybe would have liked. But now when I look back with this kind of clarity, I see those two men. The one with the railroad conductor's hat and the overalls, smoking cigar, his fly fishing sunglasses. And the other one, the often mild-mannered but intense, offensive-minded wizard. The train conductor of us all. They were there. They were present in my life. Every late summer through the fall, when I was 6 years old until the time I was 13. Perhaps we could have played basketball instead of football all this time, and maybe Coach Scott and Coach Forty would have coached us through that, and maybe we'd have had the same experiences. But I just don't think so. I think football informed all of the emotion for all of those years. For there's very few endeavors where there's a kind of intensity that is needed and desired. More than that is really accepted. Something about the bravery and cruelty and ferocity that's needed. It's instilled in people. And So where it's not about the story of a game, it's about the story of people. Probably the central figure that really speaks to all of this and really epitomizes what I think of as a warrior, as a football player, as a coach, and really as a human being, is Coach 40. Unfortunately, by the time I found Coach Scott, Coach 40 had passed away. One of the meanest and angriest men in some regards. You would have thought that he would have outlived us all. I remember Coach with his railroad conductor cap and those overalls, his fly fishing sunglasses, and the smell of Swisher Sweet cigars all over him and all over us, all over the field. Coach 40 was one of the most intense people I have ever known. To get us fired up on game day, he would come down the line taking off his railroad conductor cap and headbutt us all with our helmets on. He was one mean son of a gun, that was for sure, but there was a whole other side to Coach 40 that speaks to this poetry and artfulness of athletics. It was a side to him that I didn't know about. I don't know if anybody else knew about on the team, but as I sat down with Coach Scott for the first time in almost 25 years, I learned about this side of Coach 40, a much gentler side.
I always thought when it comes to John, that was some pretty good stuff, talking about how this big, tough guy tied flies. And you go to one of these expositions, and they got these guys putting the flies in the cup. You ever seen that? In a paper cup? John could do that easily.
And so maybe even us kids could have guessed that Coach was a great fly fisherman. After all, he wore those sunglasses that helped him peer below the water to see the fish a little bit better. But there was another side.
An artist. John had a degree in art. Was an art teacher. One of his, my favorite pencils that he did was like underwater from a fish's perspective of a guy fishing up on the bank, and it was just so cool. And he did eagles, and it was all wildlife stuff.
Hearing Coach Scott talk so fondly about Coach 40 made me want to know more. Made me want more stories, but then I remembered that I had my own. We all had our Coach 40 stories, because how could you forget somebody like him?
We went to Evergreen and played that great Evergreen team. And I don't know what happened. It was raining, and we were having a little trouble with the snap.
It was a preseason game, and I just couldn't get my hand on the ball. It was so wet. And I, the holy quarterback of our team, couldn't get the snap from center about 4, 5, maybe even 6 times in 1 half. In all, I think we pretty much sucked. I remember missing a block on a kickoff that I should have made to spring our runner for a touchdown, but instead I flubbed it, and Coach 40 almost tore my head off and ate all of my future children.
Halftime, he was furious, and the parents had all had plastic. They were gathered behind you guys and was holding the plastic up and created a canopy for all of us because it was raining so hard. You guys are all kneeling there, and the parents, you know, obviously are under the plastic also. And, man, it's rough, and I'm coming over, and I'm thinking, okay, now, you know, obviously, what am I going to say? And I start, and here comes John, and he starts up one side of you guys, and he's furious, you know, the little spittle out the corner of his mouth. And I'm watching this, and he gets to the end, and he's ripping up the other side, and I looked at all you guys, and all you guys' eyes were big. And you were standing at attention, and I looked at the parents. Their eyes were big, and they were all standing at attention. That's one of my favorite John stories. If I could have held it together at John's services, I was going to get up and say that one. That I'll never forget. That's one of the things about John. He was a very unique guy that had all the talent that he had. And under all that was a huge heart. There's nothing he wouldn't do for you either. I'm going to miss him. Already do.
And I certainly will miss him too. I never have known anybody that possessed the kind of intensity that Coach 40 did, or the kind of verve, really. He didn't hold his tongue back, and he had a special kind of fight inside of him that is really virtuous. It was apparent when he coached.
Phil Schreiner, John's hockey coach. John learned how to coach basically from him, you know. Different sport, but there's a way to coach. Don't care what the sport is. You know, there's a mentality. There's a how you treat your players, how you respect your players, how you discipline your players. This guy was John's hero. Well, he was at the service, and I never really met him, but I felt like I knew him. He gets up, and he's talking about John's hockey. Well, everybody on every team was scared to death of John because he was the baddest guy out there. And John was a defenseman, and he never scored a goal. His last game, he scored a goal, and he was so happy. He come running over the bench, and you know the hockey door where they do the line changes? It was unlocked. And he went to hug Coach Schreiner, and the door went in, and it trapped Coach Schreiner's feet. So John went over and landed on him and split Coach Schreiner's head open, and they were so happy. But he was laughing and crying when he was telling that story.
I suppose this is all part of the conversation that you don't have when you're 6 and 7 years old with your coaches. But here and now, as an adult, sitting in front of my childhood football coach, one of my heroes, one half of the team of my total superheroes, you get to ask these kinds of questions and reveal that kind of humanity, peel back the curtain, and really kind of see who they were. To us as kids, Coach Forty and Coach Scott were inseparable. There was a bit we knew about him, but there was a whole history that we knew nothing about. So it was a treat for me to sit back and be able to ask these questions to Coach Scott about he and Coach Forty. Who were they?
I met him when, 68. We were 18, I suppose. And John had been in a lot of trouble for fighting and stuff. And I knew he'd been in a lot of trouble for that. He couldn't control his temper, plus he was, you know, a tough guy. And I remember once he told me when he finally started to get it was when the police called Mr. Forty and said, "We've got John down here, Mr. Forty. We need you to come down." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what you do. Why don't you just keep him for a while? Because I know he's safe down there, and I'll come down sometime and get him." And he let John sit down there for a couple days. He kind of changed since then. I met John. We became pretty instant friends. I was best man in his wedding when he married Patty. Dad was a Chicago Mafia guy. Changed his name, moved out here.
And the other thing that I didn't know about Coach Forty was that he was a Golden Gloves heavyweight state boxing champion as well.
Watching him work on a speed bag, watching him skipping rope, it was like when you see a few... go back to Ray Leonard and those kind of guys. It was like watching one of those guys.
And so, looking back on it, it now makes sense. Coach Forty, Coach Scott kind of trained us to be boxers, to be not only supreme athletes, but warriors of some kind. And for certain, it all centered around athletics, but really it was about the cast of characters, the players, the kids that I grew up with. We started at the age of 6 and ended at the age of 13. Some players stayed the entire duration, like myself. Some quit playing, and some started in the middle of it all. During that time, we played almost countless games for a kid, really. It's almost too many games to count, but it's really the players and the kids around me that I remember. Sure, I remember a lot of the games, a lot of the situations, a lot of the moments, but it was the characters around me that really resonate to this day. As an adult, I spend time usually on the players, like Gus Kearney, number 72, the kid that moved away in the middle of it all, or number 77, Joaquin Garbiso, kid that loved to laugh, always had a belly full of laughs, and he kicked the ball off in that straight-ahead, old-style kind of way. I think about others like John Tachik, who was a bit smaller than me, but was one of our workhorses. He was a kid that was absolutely fearless. I would BMX bike with him in the off-season, and never really seen too many other kids so ferocious at those jumps and so fearless, really, and translated into the football field. During our 10-year-old season, our star running back didn't make weight, so he couldn't play in the backfield.
John was all we had. Do you remember he got the ball every play? He was carrying it 30, 35 times a game. He was all we had. I could see the look in his mom's eye that she was a little concerned.
And she was concerned because John was coming home after practice with bruises all over his body, after games with bruises all over his body. He would crash through the offensive line and the defensive line into the linebacking core with a reckless abandon that was really admirable, especially for somebody of his stature. And there were others, like Jason Perkins, number 21. He played as a linebacker, but just like Tachik, he was not the biggest kid on the field. What Perkins had, though, was that he was one of the meaner kids on the field, one of the tougher ones. As we aged, a lot of the players grew tall, grew big, but it was people like me and Perkins and Tachik that didn't so much. Nevertheless, Perkins was there, number 21, right in the thick of it all, a linebacker, right in the middle of every single tackle, hard-nosed and gritty all the time. At one point, Perkins had gotten into trouble outside of football and was taken to coach as a kind of reprimand, as a kind of setting straight. And as coach was fleshing out the situation with Perkins, Jason told him, "Coach, I think my problem is that I'm just not scared of anything at all."
It was interesting that he was troubled by the fact that he knew he was afraid of nothing. That should trouble you. You need to be afraid of something. On the football field, on the racetrack, etc., maybe you should be afraid of nothing. But out there in life, you better get some fear.
I ran into Perkins once as an adult, and it did appear that he still was quite fearless and quite reckless. Something about our interaction did strike a chord of fear in me, to some extent. I wonder where Perkins is now, in the same way that I wonder where 00 Chris Lang is, or number 30 Chris Williams, probably our most talented athlete on the team, or tight end, or defensive leader, the guy who I threw most of my pass plays to, including that famous game-winning pass that I've carried with me all these years. I think of Mike Merrill, number 17, wonder where he is and how he is. It's the stories of these guys that stick with me, their character, their individual flair, their idiosyncrasies. I think of Josh Estrada, old number 12, a running back. Somebody who I actually looked up to. I just thought the kid was cool. He had that Jeff Spicoli kind of casualness, but a real kind of artfulness to everything that he did. I remember the Super Bowl game where he got the ball in a dive play and squeezed through the middle and popped out on the other side of the defense. He had nothing but about 40 yards of open field in front of him. But Josh wasn't the fastest kid on the team, but he did have the best jukes that I'd ever seen as a kid. Kind of like Sweetness, but in slow motion. Instead of running those 40 yards straight dead ahead, he had to juke the entire team that caught up behind him. And I think he probably ended up running over 100 yards to gain those 40. But probably the only one that rivaled Coach 40's very particular idiosyncrasies and intensity was the grand workhorse of our team. The only guy who I've ever seen smash a face mask. 3 games in a row, he laid out kids. He broke various bones in their body. The ambulance had to come to the field and take these kids away. So, come the 4th game, we show up and the ambulance is actually there, waiting. He was a kid of intense ferocity, but there was also another side to old number 93.
Steve Hawes, I'm exaggerating, said 5 words to me in 7 years. Steven is one of my heroes. Steven had run the ball, and they'd blow the whistle, somebody's hurt. Well, you know, in these big collisions, it's always the running back, you know. And there'd be 2 defenders down. A lot of times, the coaches after the game were furious at me, you know, because we used to beat these teams so bad. And this coach come up to me, and he said, "I respect you a lot, coach, but that number 93 was tackling my players and tackling my son, and he was grabbing, my son's got marks on him wherever he was grabbing him." So I come over the sidelines and I said, "Guys, one of our players, I'm not going to say who, the coach told me, was like, when he'd get him down, he was like grabbing him so hard, he was leaving marks and stuff. But anyway, good job, Steven." And I shook his hand and you guys went crazy.
I can picture Steven now in that moment, probably smiling and really kind of evil grin. But I doubt he even said anything. I doubt he really cavorted with the rest of us. I'm sure we all just hammered down on his shoulder pads and slapped his helmet and gave him high fives. There was something altogether different about number 93, about the way that he carried himself and where he came from.
Well, did Steve come to practice and he'd have bloody elbows, bloody knees, his shoulder pad didn't look right, one of the top pads was gone. He just looked like, let's just say the society, everybody walked around in football uniforms in our society. That's just how we dressed. You know, the rich, the Bruin kids over here, all had shiny helmets and nice. And then the poor kids. Steve looked like one of the poor kids with the broken down uniforms. And he had to ride the bus. to school.
Sometimes he'd have to ride his bike to practice from his house, way down south, carrying all of his football gear with him, packaged in the way that we used to package it. And there was this kind of way that you would carry your gear to the football field. You'd put your helmet inside your shoulder pad so that the face mask was peeking up out of the head hole. You'd hold on to that and you'd have your jersey draping down over the whole unit. Kind of like a football duffel bag. And here comes Steven, riding up on his bike for practice.
Two bloody elbows, bloody knees, half the shoulder pads missing, and there he was. There he was.
Thing was, is that this didn't happen just once. It happened multiple times. It was kind of how I remember Steven in a lot of ways. But there was never any cause for alarm or any exclamation coming from him at all. He certainly wasn't scared of blood. He broke his face mask. He broke kids' arms. He probably had the most scars on his helmet of anybody on our team. Maybe it was just because it was the oldest helmet on the team. But I'm sure it's because he hit the hardest and the most frequently. Still, there just was this gentility to this bear.
I always remember how Steven, when he made a play, he stood up slowly and kind of grabbed his face mask, and his head was down a little bit, and he just walked back to the huddle. That you rarely saw him jump up and pound his chest. He'd have his head kind of down and just walk back to the huddle, and I thought that was so cool seeing Steven do that. And if you'll see in that Bruins game, there's a kickoff, and they're running it right towards our sidelines, and there's Steven, and he's in a perfect cheetah stance, and this guy gets here, and he just launches, and I mean, it's just boom, right to the ground. It's just beautiful.
I remember when I was about 10 years old, I ran into Steven in the park during the summer when we weren't in football season. He had a huge trash bag full of aluminum cans. He was on the playground, scooping up sand inside of those cans, and I remember asking him, "Why are you doing that? What are you doing?" Steven calmly told me that he was taking the cans down to the can bank, that place where they paid you for recycling the cans based on the weight, and he said, "Right now I'm weighing them down so I can make more money." I thought it was kind of ingenious, really, and he was carrying those gigantic trash bags full of those aluminum cans weighted down with all that sand on his bicycle, all by himself. I wonder who put him up to it, or if anybody did. Who taught him this trick? I befriended Steven. We would spend the night at each other's houses and wake up with him at the crack of dawn and run his paper route with him. We'd stay up all night just telling inane stories and walking around his neighborhood. One morning after he spent the night at my house, my mother made French toast for us. She called us up to eat, and Steven ate first. Guests always ate first. Then I started eating, and by the time I was done, Steven was still eating. I excused myself from the table and went on with my morning, and Steven stayed. He ate, and when it was all said and done, Steven had eaten an entire loaf of bread in the form of French toast. Now, let's fast forward to that second to last game, the most beautiful moment of my childhood, the game against the Cherry Creek Bruins. We were losing bad in the first half. I could just feel them overpowering us. They were jumping the pass routes and really just kind of pummeling us. I didn't feel like we could move the ball very well and just couldn't really gain a foothold in the tug of war. As I said, my mother left at halftime because she couldn't bear seeing us, this great team that had won Super Bowls and was at the top of the standings throughout our entire childhood, lose that bad and that way at the very end. We came out for the second half, and then the third quarter turned into the fourth quarter, and as the sun set over the Rocky Mountains, we began moving the ball in the Bruins on this plane that overlooked that sunset. We would score, but then they would score.
Then they got up two on us, so it was basically over, because time's running out.
Then, in the fourth quarter, I threw a long pass to Biakowski. He caught it. That set up a score to put us within six, but time was winding down. In those days, we didn't go by a time system, we went by a play count system, and at this point, there was only five plays left, and we had to kick off the ball to the Bruins. Our defense lined up for the kick, and old number 77, Joaquin, kicked it with his Tom Dempsey foot straight down the field. The ball bumbled end over end, hopping erratically down the field until it landed in the arms and the cradle of one of their players, but he was promptly ate up by a red wave. And in the ensuing melee, in that pile, where it definitely looked like it was Cherry Creek's ball, somehow, out of that pile emerged number 93 with the football. For me, this was Jesus disappearing from the tomb. It was a true miracle. It was unbelievable. They had the ball, and underneath that pile, somehow, Stephen wrestled the ball away from that kid. It was there that something began to make sense, something that had been happening for that whole last quarter of the game. In our huddle, our sacred offensive huddle, Steve was knelt before me on the ground, and he was screaming at all of us. He was saying the same thing over and over. This is our game. This is our game. First, I thought that he was a little insane, that it wasn't our game, this was not our day, and we were going to leave with a loss. But it seemed in everything that Stephen did that day, he knew something a little bit different, and he was chanting us on. When he emerged from that pile with that football, he kind of did what he always did, which was simply head to the next order of business. This, all while pandemonium exploded all around him from our sideline.
You remember that? Were you right there? Right in front of me, the coach's kid, Asoba, 19. Clearly, I was right there. He clearly got the ball. But you know who the next guy was for us right there? Steven. Then the pile, and Steven comes out of it with the ball.
Then, with only 5 plays left, we went to work. We tossed the ball right to Donnie. Number 34 gained a couple off the right edge. Then, the next play, we lined up. I came up to the ball, and my cadence, as per the usual, ready, hike, they jumped. It was one of the few times that we went on 2. Our coaches had always, since we were 6 years old, gone on 1. It was always ready, hike. This was part of the brilliance of everything that they did. Just like the next play, a belly left to Steven. Instead of some complicated name and number for a play that was really quite simple, which was just Steven off the left edge between the tackle and the end in that hole, we just called it belly left or belly right. There was an ultimate simplicity to everything that we did, a tactical kind of formation, as a result, a kind of regality. Then, with 3 plays left, was a belly right to Donnie. Number 34 crashed into the line and bounced out at the linebackers and crashed out of bounds. From there, it was first down at the 11-yard line, with only 2 plays left in the entire game here, and I was pulled, as we customarily did, for 1 play, where Speedy John Tachik would line up, ready, hike, and burst out one of the sides of the line, either the left or the right, for a reverse, or on this occasion, a fake reverse. He gained a couple, but not much. So, with 1 play left in the game, we were left with a pass play. We needed 6 yards, and if it wasn't obvious to them, it was obvious to us what was about to happen. The play was only surprising in the fact that the pass went to the right side, not the left. We broke the huddle, came up to the line, surveyed the defense, then, really quickly, ready, hike. I lunged to my left and faked the handoff. Looked to my right, and the defense had already broken through our offensive line a bit, and our end, Mike Merrill, was covered. Still, I rolled a little bit to my right and off the back foot, let it rip. And Mike, leaping off his feet, came to meet my pass, the corner of the end zone, diving, heaving, miraculously scoring. The game then was tied, so we lined up for the extra point. And if it wasn't obvious to them, it was obvious to us. But I think something in them was defeated, for when I got up to the line, called my cadence, faked the handoff to the right, and peeled back around to my left, the most athletic kid on our team, running the route that we had been running on teams for the last 5 years, was standing out there all by himself. Through my muscle memory, I just let it go. And it hit him right between the numbers. He caught it. Jubilation. There was something about those plays and that time, that moment. It was a fulcrum point for my entire childhood. It was my swing into adolescence and the real loss of innocence. Looking back on it and being able to sit down with Coach Scott, learning about him as a humanoid and an adult. Now, what I am, was intriguing. I learned about his background and why he picked up Chris and I every summer to show us the first new couple of plays and take us to Bronco Burgers, and why he put forth so much effort, why he had the pizza party before the season began where they showed us the Dick Butkus tape and the NFL films, where we all sat packed in Coach Scott's little house and watching and eating and being a part of a family. I asked him if he ever had a family just quite like the one that we did with that football team, and he said a couple times it was close, but not really. And where Coach 40 was an explicit artist, Coach Scott was too. There was something about his play design, its simplicity, the chants that they had us do, the warm-up drills, the theory and philosophy behind almost everything that we did. There was a real thoughtfulness to almost everything that we engaged in, and how profound is that? The shaping of these creatures with this kind of thoughtfulness, this kind of artfulness, this designing of plays and structure and practice and years of time together. Years that were the most formative years in our lives, in all of our lives. I asked Coach Scott why it was that I was quarterback, because I wasn't the fastest kid on the team. I wasn't the tallest, strongest. I couldn't throw the ball the furthest. But I took a profound pride in being the quarterback of that team. I thought it was my destiny at that point. I thought I was the next John Elway or Joe Montana. But the truth of the matter was that Coach thought me to be the most loyal kid on the team. He told me that you don't put your best athlete under center. You give the ball to your best athlete. You need somebody who is smart, who is going to conduct the huddle, and who is going to be at the center of that team in a way that helps facilitate everything that the coach wishes and desires. And I was his little leader on that field. So no, he didn't pick me because I had the best arm, the best capability. In the end, I was just one of the many colors in his toolbox for use on that green field. Coach Scott and Coach 40 were truly artists. While we were paintbrushes and colors at the time, we were also very much artists. And I can only hope that people like Chunk and Batichuk and Silverstein and Miles and Potoff and Martinez, that all those kids have grown up to be artists in some way or another, and that those days, those golden days, affected them as much as they affected me.